Hey guys, welcome back to the forum where science comes to socialize. I'm Cleo.
I'm Daniela.
And I'm Aubrey.
And today we'll be discussing a topic we've talked about a few other times on the forum, California's water.
And whether you're from California, another water insecure area, or literally anywhere else in the world, we hope you can join us in this conversation by connecting with us over social media. You can find us on Twitter at ISGP Forum and on Facebook at ISGP's The Forum. And don't forget to use our hashtag ISGP Forum with all your posts.
All right, so with a topic like water issues in California, you may think you've heard it all before, whether here on the forum or on the news or on your Twitter feed. You know what I'm talking about here. Take shorter showers, don't water your lawn, agriculture is using up all the water to feed the country, all that stuff.
But a piece of this equation that we may sometimes forget is that we humans are not the only ones relying on this water. In fact, entire ecosystems rely on adequate, clean water supplies, and they are suffering arguably as much or even more than Californians.
So today, as we wade through this episode, because, water.
God.
Anyway, we'll address some human-related issues, but we'll also be paying particular attention to how California's water battle affects aquatic ecosystems, why this even matters, and what we need to be doing to ensure that these fragile environments don't disappear.
So to kick us off, we have a policy position paper here written by Dr. Christina Swanson, the director of the Science Center at the National Resources Defense Council in San Francisco. Her paper, titled Managing Water for People and Fish, Now and in a Changing Climate, was debated at the 2016 ISGP conference, Water and Fire: Impacts of Climate Change, which was held at and in partnership with Sacramento State University.
And this conference is especially near and dear to my heart, as it was my first conference managing a group of interns. And I have to say that the Sacramento State students did a phenomenal job.
And it was my first time in California, so that was super cool.
Okay, let's not forget that I didn't physically attend this conference, so if we could keep the bragging to a minimum today, that would be super fab.
No need to be bitter, Aubrey. It's not like we visited San Francisco Giants Stadium without you.
And if you did, you would literally never hear the end of it.
Okay, guys, let's get on topic, shall we? Okay, so essentially, Dr. Swanson argues that recent droughts have exposed weaknesses in California's water management strategies, and these weaknesses have effects on humans, aquatic ecosystems, and the fish they contain. Because of this, we seriously need to start realizing our limits when it comes to water, and we have to start planning and allocating appropriately for current and future water demands.
And in particular, we need to work on better protecting these aquatic ecosystems that get overlooked when discussing water and drought and climate. Droughts are pushing many aquatic species to their brink, including several fish species considered to be biological indicators for ecosystem health.
Current policies and management are simply not meeting these responsibilities of protection or use when it comes to California's water, particularly for aquatic ecosystems and fish. And we need new policies based on the functions, requirements, and limits of the water system. The cool thing about this topic is that scientists and researchers already have a lot of the information they need for us to make this a reality. The not so cool thing is that actually implementing policies surrounding these issues is rather difficult.
Well, I can't really say I'm surprised about that, but let's not get too far into the conversation without setting the stage first. We're talking about California's water, and this immediately implicates California's water rights, aka California's water allocation system. So we should probably provide a refresher on water rights here. But if you want a more in-depth discussion of those, then be sure to check out episode 3.
Okay, so turns out that despite California being ahead of the game compared to the rest of the US in terms of sustainability and having climate change models inform their development, the state's water management revolves around a pretty archaic water rights system that no longer realistically applies to California's economy or population. Basically, California's water rights structure dates back to the Gold Rush era, and rights created before 1914 can't be touched by many state regulations. The result? A system with a fairly arbitrary set of winners and losers, compromising the state's ability to deliver water in a fair and effective manner during those awful drought periods.
And not to majorly call it out or anything, but this water system has failed on multiple levels. Okay, so maybe a slight call out there. But what I mean is that water rights fail to meet the demand of their many, many users, and they also don't appropriately protect or manage aquatic ecosystems and fisheries, which, by the way, have suffered severe harm during the most recent droughts.
All right, well, let's talk a bit about that. Due to dams and diversions, California's Sacramento San Joaquin watershed and delta have experienced chronic man-made drought for 12 of the past 15 years. This is in part due to variable annual water flows, but also because about 50% of the water flow has been diverted for personal and economic uses. Today, the average amount of water flowing from the delta into the San Francisco Bay estuary is less than the estuary would have ever received in the driest 20% of free-flowing years.
In the Delta, the biological resources, like the declining populations of estuary fish that rely on the now depleted aquatic ecosystems, are the first to feel the impact of low water flow. And while some of these species are resilient and adaptable, like salmon and smelt, the decreased water flow and dam-blocked access to cooler upstream water have resulted in warmer water temperatures, putting a whole bunch of stress on these cold water fish populations.
And while fish population declines and ecosystem degradation are occurring partially due to water contamination, destruction of marshes and riparian habitat, and invasive plants and fish species, which are, in themselves a whole other issue.
Like how contaminants present in extremely low concentrations might still affect fish reproductive capacity.
Right, but we're not discussing that one today. Anyway, the decreased water flow that we are talking about today is a way more significant driver of the problem.
Things really aren't looking good for the fish here, are they?
Yeah, not really. And I'm trying to figure out how to tie some sort of twisted version of the Little Mermaids under the sea into this, but under the estuaries and streams just doesn't really have the same ring to it.
That was beautifully dark. Thank you.
Okay, well, while we're talking about singing fish and greedy mermaids, though, it turns out that some scientists are developing genetic modifications, sometimes referred to as assisted evolution, that can help fish thrive in present conditions when they can't adapt fast enough to changes caused by the climate or human interference.
Very cool. I doubt it involves the fish singing and dancing, or the creation of real-life mermaids for that matter, but beggars can't be choosers.
No worries about that real-life mermaid thing, though. Haven't you seen those minute-long Facebook clips advertising places in Florida or Mexico or wherever that you can go and take some mermaid lessons?
Like, tail fin and all?
Tail fin and all.
I can't even sometimes.
If you can't even so much, then you're not invited to join Danielle and me on our just planned vacation to Florida. I'm totally getting in on this mermaid life thing.
I'm devastated.
Okay, all right. But I actually do have a question that's relevant. I could have sworn that sustainable water management has been improving lately. Maybe I'm crazy. Why isn't this helping?
What I think you're referring to, Dee, is the 2014 Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, or SGMA, which was definitely a step in the right direction because of how it called for better local and regional management of groundwater use. I won't get into all the details, but basically, SGMA incorporates three existing bills that focus on managing groundwater basins at a local scale, where it would prove most effective. However, environmental water protections were weakened during the California drought when, in 2014 to 2015, the State Water Resources Control Board waived environmental protection in the Sacramento estuary and eliminated the need to provide minimal flow, the minimum amount of designated water needed to keep ecosystems and society moving forward.
And it also doesn't help that other important water protections don't adequately prevent ecosystem contamination from stormwater and agricultural runoff. A very recent example of this is how the language of the Clean Water Act is in the process of being modified to change the definition of the phrase waters of the U.S. So, to break it down for you a little, in 2015, the EPA published the Clean Water Rule to define the scope of federal water protection in a more consistent manner, particularly over streams and wetlands, which was totally great because this rule alleviates concerns about the lack of clarity over its scope from legislators at multiple levels, industry members, researchers, and other science professionals, activists, and citizens.
Yeah, but then the current presidential administration announced in 2017 that it has intent to review and rescind or revise this rule. So this is kind of a bummer.
Nevertheless, in this discussion, we obviously can't forget or separate out the fact that the people of California are suffering with these water issues too, not just the aquatic ecosystems.
While it may be scientifically rational to prioritize environmental allocations above human drinking water in some cases, because ecosystems actually do contribute to water security, societal values demand that human use be given the top priority.
And poor water management disadvantages numerous communities, most likely due to California's public utilities model. Currently, this model is based on multiple distribution entities rather than one large entity with central bases that could provide smaller communities with resources and oversight.
Luckily, though, a movement to designate water as a human right has emerged. About time, am I right? And it's been progressing. It's driven in part by the uneven distribution of safe drinking water in California and around the nation. The lead contamination in Flint, Michigan's water supply was definitely a driver at the forefront of this movement. Obviously, this kind of movement could have wide-ranging effects on water management and distribution.
Which kind of makes us unsure about where water allocation for aquatic ecosystems fits into that bigger picture, seeing as policymakers are already having a hard enough time dealing with the issues before throwing emphatic public opinion and movements into the mix. Political squabbles over which factors should play the biggest roles in policy decisions have already significantly stalled implementation of water-related environmental strategies.
And because water policy and management decisions are often based on political concerns rather than scientific understanding, multiple players fiercely compete within the state system to protect their own interests. This has resulted in agricultural users wielding a disproportionate amount of political clout relative to their sector's contribution to the state's economy. Agricultural usage consumes 4 times more water than individual, urban, or industrial use. But the agricultural sector has largely resisted voluntary water conservation.
Worth noting, though, is the fact that 17,000 seasonal and part-time agricultural jobs were lost in 2014 due to the drought. The debaters seem to think that opportunity exists here to identify new employment opportunities and plan for a long-term shift from the current agricultural model to a more sustainable economic model for the entire state.
Something sort of at odds with this idea, though, is that revising water rights is described as a torturous process that Californians have avoided thus far, instead operating as if the state needs to reprioritize and reallocate water resources within the current water management system, rather than doing a total upheaval and rewrite of the system.
But even to keep working within the existing system, California would need cost-benefit analyses that consider the priorities of individual, environmental, and economic usage in order to inform and propel decision-making. These are things like the environmental cost of polluted runoff in the San Joaquin Valley versus the economic benefit of agricultural production.
Or the costs and benefits of using selected areas for floodplain and recharge versus, development. With this also comes the need for multidisciplinary science and engineering collaborations. These groups could potentially come up with solutions to challenges affecting multiple stakeholders within this whole water equation.
To give you a little scenario of where this would be useful, because land development causes water to flow faster through an area and can disrupt the vital surface groundwater connection, thus affecting more than just the immediate area, strategies are needed that increase water infiltration, such as setting back levees and repurposing land. So it's useful to have people with multiple backgrounds working on this.
And although much of the research and data needed for high-level water management decisions exist, there are critical gaps in scientific knowledge, like the effects of groundwater pumping on surface water, for instance.
Oh, but because of this, there are really opportunities here to better integrate citizens and other end users into improving sustainability, by developing local solutions that utilize water more effectively. So things like stormwater capture or green infrastructure. And then we can provide opportunities for communities to recognize and actually engage with water issues.
Nothing like some good citizen science talk to make everyone at the forum extra happy.
For real, it's literally the best.
Not having these issues in the first place would be arguably better, but I guess that's not quite as realistic, is it?
Well, with the information we do have, we know that there are lots of viable strategies for reducing water demand and thus saving more for our finned fish friends. These include playing around with pricing, regulations, and incentives.
On the other side of the equation, though, strategies to increase water supplies often require vast amounts of energy that can be costly and contribute to greenhouse gas emissions. Think desalination or tertiary treatment of wastewater here.
In this predicament lies an opportunity for someone to figure out how to simultaneously address the energy required to increase the water supply and the challenges facing renewable solar and wind energy, which at certain times of day exceed the energy demands on the power system. It's possible that water recycling plants and desalination plants could actually be important outlets for using excess renewable energy, balancing the energy grid.
Two birds with one stone. I like it.
It's not just these individual fixes that will save California's water, though. We need a whole reprioritization.
Pulling us back to reality, D. But yeah, you're definitely right. The current system of historical water allocation needs to be shifted to one that's more sustainable. The State Water Resources Control Board then needs to undertake the difficult task of bringing together all users to parse out water rights based on empirical information and pre-established priorities.
Part of this equation, again, is support in California and across the country for this emerging movement to designate clean water as a human right. While these rights are being worked out, the state's practice of supplying water when local public utilities cannot meet a community's requirements needs to be continued and expanded.
Rights alone don't assure availability, though. We can't forget that water is a finite resource. Because of this, we still really require proactive water management throughout the state that oversees freshwater and groundwater as one unit. Such management must also base water allocations on the assumption that each year will be a drought year, with any surplus placed in storage.
All right, I know that when prioritizing water uses, we have to put people first. But the debaters also gave us a few more prioritization suggestions beyond this, too. Given the integral connections between water flow, health of aquatic ecosystems, and water supply sustainability for all users, California needs to give water for environmental sustainability a higher priority than water for economic use, which I know will go over fantastically with the agricultural community.
Not.
I know, right?
Okay, but there are a few criteria that can help prioritize water allocations to private sector water users as well. These include, number one, total economic value of the enterprise to the state, and two, local and national usage, so not for international export.
There's also number three, possibility for water recharge, four, farm size with preference for family farms, and five, flexibility of water demand. So orchards have inflexible water demands from year to year, but some crops can be replaced with lower water use varieties when necessary.
But within these priorities, it's still important to ensure that there are enough crops to meet demand, and that the state helps agricultural producers and workers transition to new enterprises, which includes providing job training opportunities.
Seems like a lot to juggle for sure. I know the debaters thought another key piece in all of this was increasing conservation and reducing demand for water in the first place. And in order to do that, we're going to need both regulations and incentives to empower users to better understand and manage their water resources.
Back to the no watering your lawn game.
Empowering the users can be done through options like tiered pricing, which has been shown to be effective at improving water conservation. Or the water management system could follow the demand reduction example of electrical utilities, which pay big users to cut back during periods of reduced supply or peak demand.
Given the demonstrated lack of compliance by water users to do voluntary monitoring, though, again, people who leave the faucet on when brushing their teeth don't make any sense to me, the state also needs to require, not request, that users report the amount of water used from local streams as a condition of having access to these waterways.
We can't pretend that all this isn't going to be expensive or tricky, but the debaters thought these actions were necessary to save both Californians and their ecosystems. Although it's extremely costly to mitigate the damage to aquatic ecosystems caused by changing climate and water management, think decreased flow, increased temperature, lost habitat, higher concentrations of contaminants, all that, taxpayers need to commit to long-term infrastructure investments as a key part of water security, and there needs to be ways to share these costs with the private sector.
An example of where this is already happening is the San Francisco Water Quality Control Board, which has a monitoring program that's funded by dischargers as part of the cost of doing big business.
And let's wrap things up here by reiterating just how important scientifically informed policy truly is. Since policy decisions based on economics or societal values and not at all informed by science may not work and can prove costly and damaging in the long term, scientifically informed engagement by all stakeholders is essential when it comes to water management. I'm speaking to all the political leaders and policy directors in particular here.
So clearly, there's a lot to be said for California's water usage and supply and demand. But there's even more to be done.
Do you think that the suggestions the ISGP debaters laid out at this conference are actually viable? Will prioritizing ecosystem health behind human consumption get anything accomplished? Heck, would the broad public ever get behind putting the ecosystem first?
Or maybe you think ecosystem health should be prioritized behind economic gain. Whatever your opinion is, let us know on Twitter or Facebook, and be sure to use the hashtag ISGPForum. We're really curious to get your perspectives here.
Thanks so much for socializing with science today, guys. We look forward to seeing your input on today's discussion. So we'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.